All right, today's Hall of Famer, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, known as the Rav by many in the United States. His year is 1902 to 1993. So someone compared him, I think it's a very nice analogy. He was the Rambam of the 20th century. He was the Rambam of our generation. Neither of them learned in a yeshiva. Instead, they were taught by their father. Both were equally at home in the world of Torah and the world of philosophy. But for both, Torah was the ikar, philosophy was secondary. As a child of 12, 13, he used to write his chidushim in a notebook, and he would send it to his grandfather, the famous Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And Reb Chaim would take the notebook and run around and show all the rabbanim and say, look at what he wrote. This is like the Brisker Rav. This is like his father, the Beis Halevi. What my grandson is writing at the age of 12, 13. This is what he would say. And while in Berlin, he corresponded with his father. While he was at the University of Berlin, on those difficult sugyas, he was writing Chidushim, and his son later, published it in a sefer. Every shiur the Rav gave dealt with the Rambam. You come to shiur, you brought your Gemara, you brought the Rambam. And the truth is, even his childhood friend was the Rambam. Okay, what does that mean? So the Rav told this crazy story. He said that when he was a little kid, he would like play in the living room, right? And his father would give shiur. He'd have these talmidim in the, at the dining room table, and he'd give shiur. And he would be playing, with his choo-choo train. He's a little kid. He's playing in the living room while his father's giving shiur. And invariably, his father, Brisker Derech from his father, Reb Chaim, you learn the Gemara, you see the Rambam, and you deal with difficult Rambams. You'd have the Ravid asking questions. How can the Rambam say that? Doesn't make any sense. And then they would sit there and they would rack their brains to explain the Rambam. And once, the Rav says, I remember that there was this question, a very strong question on the Rambam. And my father sat there and he tried and he couldn't come up with an answer. And I ran to my mother and I said, who's going to defend the Rambam? Who's going to defend the Rambam? And she said, probably, Abba will come up with an answer, and if not, you'll defend the Rambam. Right? When I was a little kid, I was going to say, when are the Mets going to finally be good? When are they, And here, I was like, who's going to defend the Rambam? This is what was bothering the Rav. Okay. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik once said about himself, I know that I'm part of the Mesorah. Why? Because I'm the son of Reb Chaim and the father of Reb Yosef Dov. This is how he viewed himself. He goes, I'm the bridge between two great gedolim. It's not to say that he was not great. He was super duper great. But he said, I see myself as the bridge in the Mesorah between Reb Chaim and Yosef Dov. Now, one of the Rav's most famous shiurim explained the distinction between two aspects of leadership, the Beis Din HaGadol. On the one hand, the Beis Din HaGadol is to transmit the oral tradition, to be the final arbiter of law, to be the Supreme Court. This is the job of the Beis Din HaGadol. On the other hand, there's another aspect of the Beis Din HaGadol, to represent Klal Yisrael, to speak for Klal Yisrael, to be the House of Representatives, to be the Knesset. One might say that the Rav acted in these two roles as well. He was first and foremost the teacher of Torah par excellence. Once, when he was being interviewed for a newspaper, said, so who are you? What do you do? He didn't say he's a Rosh Hashiva. He said, I'm a Malamed. A Malamed is like this simple like school teacher. I'm a Malamed. And then he said, with a little twinkle in his eye, he goes, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu also says he's a Malamed. Hamalamed Torah Liamo Yisrael. He says, I'm a Malamed. That's it. About this, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, if so, he's the Malamed of the entire generation. Right? But he also became the spokesperson for modern orthodoxy. His endorsement of secular studies, including philosophy, his endorsements of religious Zionism, his pioneering policy for women's Jewish education, right? He started Maimonides. And in Maimonides, men and women, boys and girls, they had equal tracks. There was no such thing as it was in my school, where the boys and girls were separated and they had different, curriculums for Limudei Kodesh. Everyone was taught the same thing. Rav Soloveitchik gave the first Gemara Shiurins during college in the 1950s. All of this is expressed in his philosophy that Torah Chaim, addresses the realities of the world. Now, the Rav himself wrote very little. He was fond of saying, not everything that you think should you say. Not everything that you say should you write down. And not everything you write down should you publish. But many shiurim have been put into print, and every year there is more and more material, both about the Rav and by the Rav, that is put into print. His father was the Rav in Chaslovich, which is a small town in Russia. It was like primarily Lubavitchers there. And being the Rav of a community is very time. And he didn't really have time to learn with his son, Yosef Dov. And instead he hired a tutor to learn with him. Now, the Rav's mother was from the Feinstein family. Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe are cousins. And she's like, you know, she's looking at him, she's talking to him, and she sees, I don't think he's learning well. I don't think he's up to, you know, he's not doing as well as he should be doing. So next time they visited her father-in-law, the Rav's grandfather of Chaim, she like mentions, why don't you like give him a fair? Why don't you like see how he's doing in his learning? So, says to little 8-year-old Yosef Dov, what are you learning about the Basra? Good, you know, we all did that at 8. Starts asking him questions, and the Rav's not holding. He's not holding. Now, we would say, he's 8, but this is a Soloveitchik, so more is expected when you're 8. So Rav Chaim says, like, so what do you know? And he started reciting Tanya Ba'al Peh. That's what his tutor, you know? He hired a tutor. He was teaching him Tanya. Rav Chaim blew a gasket. He goes, what? Calls his son over. He goes, I don't care what kind of communal responsibilities you have. You sit and learn with my grandson every day. So Rav Rakefet, my Rebbe, he said he thinks there's 3 main influences on the Rav's life. First and foremost, his father. The Rav said in a Yahrzeit shiur for his father that from the age of 8 till 22, he learned with his father every day for several hours a day. He even listed all the mesechtas they learned. He says, we learned every day for several hours a day. And he mastered his grandfather's derech, Rav Chaim's derech of learning. This is number one. Number two, though, that Lubavitcher tutor. Why? Because he opened the Rav up to the world of Chassidut, the world of Agada, and philosophy. These are things that the average Rosh Yeshiva sort of skips over. Okay, we're up to there, I got it, the pages, let's just go, let's move on to Ahmed Bet, you know? Okay. And certainly another major influence, and where the Rav differs, his mother pushed that first she read to him Russian literature, encouraged him to read, hired for him a tutor so that he should get a high school equivalency diploma. And from there he went off to university. First the university in Warsaw, then moved on to University of Berlin. And he got a PhD in philosophy. Okay? Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein tells us in an article that the Rav really wanted to get his PhD in Rambam, showing that the Rambam was not influenced by Aristotle as much as people think, but really more Plato, right? It's more Nebuchadnezzar, it's really more Plato than Aristotle, but there was no one on the faculty that could oversee this work, so he instead did his degree, a thesis on Hermann Cohen, who was a modern Jewish philosopher during that time. Okay, fine. Now, during his time in Berlin, he became friendly with Rav Nachum Mendel Schneerson, later to be the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We'll talk about him next week. At the same time, you had Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, who went on to become the Rashiva of Chaim Berlin. At that time, you had Nechama Leibowitz, possibly the greatest expert in Chumash of this past generation. Certainly killed the class curve, if you were any of these classes, all these bright people. But anyway, they were there all in Berlin at one time. I remember Nechama Leibowitz told me, I had the schus of being studying by her for 3 years. She made fun of me. She said that Rav Soloveitchik sent his son, Rav Chaim, to learn Chumash by her. She's very flattered. And she said whenever I'd ask a question, she'd say, unlike you, he would think first. I said, okay. Because I was always like, you know, think first, then he always right on the money. Okay, great. And then she said that he told her, that his father had told him that when he was in the University of Berlin, someone once pointed her out to him. See that girl in the library with like the piles of Sfarim all around her? That's Nechama Leibowitz. She like, you know, really knows her stuff. And she was very proud. And I was like, well, but you know, if the Sfarim weren't there, maybe you would have gone down. Who knows? Whatever. Okay, that's me. I didn't say that to her. I just thought it. Now, these were all people in the University of Berlin at this time. 1932. I'm sorry. Also there, he comes in contact with Rav Chaim Heller. Rav Chaim Heller became like a father figure to the Rav. He studied by him later on, both in New York. Anytime Rav Chaim Heller came into Shir, the Rav would stop Shir, help him to his seat, put him, you know, seat him down. If you guys remember Marty Perlmutter, who was here earlier in the year, this is great-great-grandfather, Rav Chaim Heller. Okay, now, in 1932, he emigrates to the United States, and he starts Maimonides in Boston in 1937, when his son Chaim needed a school. He started Maimonides in Boston. And he was always involved. Always involved in Maimonides. Stayed involved in Maimonides all the time. And there's this beautiful story. Once he was walking through the halls of Maimonides, and he sees this kid. Right? He sees this kid. And he's like, you know, dejected. And he's like, he goes, what's the matter? He goes, oh, I got this test. I forgot all about it. I have this Chumash test. And I don't know. And the Rav said to the kid, he goes, you know, if you want, we can go to the library and like, maybe I'll help you. We could study for the test. And the kid goes, you know Chumash? And the Rav said, I don't know, we can give it a shot. Anyway, so the Rav came home that day and he told his family a little smile about the story. Fine. Many decades later, Atara Tversky, his daughter, is sitting Shiva for the Rav. And this successful doctor walks in and says, your father changed my life. So she assumed, okay, you were a student of his in YU. Says, nope. And tells the story. He goes, He was this kid. And she remembered the story. And he said, you don't get it. I had no confidence in my abilities. But I sat and I learned for a little bit with your father and I aced the test. And after I aced the test, I started realizing I could do this. And he became the successful doctor. He goes, your father changed my life. Anyway, cute little story. Now, the Rav's father had come to the United States and he was Rosh Yeshiva in YU. And in 1941, he passes away and the Rav becomes the Rosh Yeshiva in YU. He comes to YU. He fills his father's position, and in YU, he now gives the top shiur for like 44 years. He teaches thousands of students. He gives smicha to about 2,000 people, and he traveled back and forth from Boston to New York every week. The Rav refused to live in New York. He said, it's a zoo in New York. Why would he want to stay there? And he would come to New York for a few days, give shiurim, and go back to Boston, where it was more normal who wants to stay in New York. He was chairman of the Halakha Committee of the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA. He was the honorary president of Mizrahi. And while in New York, he also gave shiur once a week in this Mariah Shul in New York City. Now, in 1959, Rav Isaac Halevi Herzog, chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, of Medina Yisrael, dies, and people come to Rav Soloveitchik, and they offer him, please come and be the chief rabbi. You know, true, there's elections, but it's a done deal. We'll get the whole thing worked out. You'll be the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. And the Rav declined. Said, thanks, but no thanks. And when, you know, pushed, why not? He said, being the chief rabbi of Israel is just bureaucracy. He wants to do something. He was helping people. Now, it's interesting because he himself had campaigned in 1935 to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. But that, he felt that, you're helping people. Chief Rabbi Tel Aviv, there's Almanot, there's Yetomim, there's things to do, you're helping people. The chief rabbi of Israel is bureaucracy, and therefore he turned down the job. Now, when he came campaigning in 1935, he lost the election. The official reason is he was too young. And the Rav was young, he was 33 years old at the time, 32 years old at the time. But the unofficial reason was he wasn't a Zionist. The Rav at this time was absolutely in the camp of Aguda. Right? This is where he was. Just to give a proof, when Chaim Ozer Grzynski passed away, the Rav was chosen to be maspidim. Okay? Now, he does an about face, and we'll get to that soon. While in Eretz Israel, 1935, he meets Rav Kook. It's the last year of his life. He spoke to Rav Kook last week, 1935, and Rav Kook had known Rav Chaim from Volozhin. And he told his son, it's for you to cook, that the spirit of Rav Chaim rests upon this man. Now, Rav Avram Shapiro was also a young student at this time. He later goes on to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Merkaz Harav, and he later goes on to be the chief rabbi of Israel. And when I was in YU in the 1980s, Rav Avram Shapiro came to visit NYU. And he spoke to the yeshiva. It was like a dais, the Rav sitting at the dais. And Rav Avram was like introduced, and he gets up, and before he goes to, you know, to the microphone, he goes over to Rav Soloveitchik and he gives him a kiss. Kisses him on the head. Then he goes to the microphone and says, the mitzvah to kiss the Sefer Torah. Okay? And then he spoke to us. Now, a friend of mine had the schus of being a shamish of Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Kenny Brander. He's now like a vice president of the YU. And he told me the following story. He said, in the apartment, afterwards, they went to the Rav's apartment, they're schmoozing, and Rav Avram Shapiro told Rav Soloveitchik the following. He says, when you came in 1935, to campaign to be chief rabbi. How do you campaign to be chief rabbi? Tell your platform what you're going to do. You give shiurim. Okay. I heard that first year. I was blown away. And then, everywhere you went, I got your itinerary. And I followed you all over the place. And I listened to every shiur you gave. And then, when I was in Merkaz, any student who came from New York, came from YU, I'd say, do you have any shiurim of the rabbi? Give me your notes. And then finally, when Rav Soloveitchik allowed some of his shiurim to be put into print, it was published in Eretz Yisrael. And he told him, he goes, I told him at the publishing house, when the shiurim are still in the galleys, even before it goes to book form, I want to see every page. To which the Rav, with his sharp sense of humor, said, don't you think that's stealing? You should buy the book. Why do you give me? Okay, fine. But this was the relationship that he had. Now, the Rav was every year the keynote speaker at RCN Mizrahi conventions. Plus, he gave tshuva drashot. Many of the tshuva drashot got written up in Ala Tshuva and Yemei Zikaron. And in Saturday nights in Boston, he gave a chumashir. Every Saturday night in Boston, he gave a chumashir. Right? It was very cool. You know, people would go to hear the Rav's chumashir, then they go out on their date afterwards. You know, they discuss at the ice cream store what the Rav said. Now, the Rav was very smart. He'd say like this, look, I'm not going to go on Saturday night talk about next week's parasha, because then all the rabbis in Boston will come and listen to what I say, and no one will come up with their own drushes. They'll just steal my material. So an uncle of mine was a rabbi in Boston, so he said, so what do we all do? We took notes, and we stole the rabbi's material for the next year. Okay. But everyone came. They listened to the Rav Shiram. Okay. Now, the Rav also was known to give these amazing hespedim and yortzei shiram for his father. The Rav had the ability to weave together halacha and agadah, Talmud and Rambam, Shulchan Aruch and Midrash, Zohar and Moreh Nevuchim, and an our world of seven-word sound bites, and then move on to the next topic. It's astounding that the Rav gave 4, sometimes 5-hour yortzei shiurim. And people sat there, you know, on the edge of their seats, writing down every word that he said. The Rav would choose a topic, something from like Orach Chaim, something that people had heard of, not some esoteric, you know, concept, but, you know, tzitzis or tefillin or kriyat shema, and he'd take this topic, and he would throw out question after question after question. He'd say, all these problems. Oh, I never thought of, oh, that's a problem. And then with one sweeping sfara, he would explain how everything ties together, and now we understand all the questions, go back and explain every single question. Someone once described it as someone taking a whole bunch of ribbons, throwing it on the table, and then just tying it all together in this beautiful bow. And then the Rav would pause, take a drink of water, and say, you want more? And the audience would go, yeah! And then on the same topic, he would now do agadata. And he would deal with the same idea from a hashkava point of view, from a machshava point of view, for another 2 hours, 2.5 hours. This was like this unbelievable highlight. People came from all over. They had to, this is long before they had all the stuff that we have. They open up closed circuit TV and other rooms overflow. There was enough people in the big auditorium. People wanted to hear this. Okay. It's a testimony to the Rav's extraordinary genius combined with exceptional oratory skills. Once a person came over to Rav Soloveitchik after he gave a public shiur and said, Rav Soloveitchik, you're an actor. To which the Rav responded, absolutely. Absolutely. You're going to be a public speaker? Absolutely. You've got to be dramatic. Yes, 100%. Now, in the summer, you had people that would sit with Rav Soloveitchik on Tisha B'Av, the Rav Adam Shachris, and then they start saying Kinas. So what do? Our shuls, we say Kinas, skip as much as we can, and in about an hour, we move out of shul. The Rav went through all the Kinas and explained every single thing. And they'd sit there for 8 hours. 8 hours. I mean, it's Tisha B'Av, where are you going? 8 hours, right? And the Rav would explain ideas. I need all these different ideas. And then only later, oh, now it's right in the middle of the afternoon, Dam Mincha, right? This is what was done. Whenever the Rav taught, there was a packed crowd. And this is because he had the ability to explain the most complex technical subjects with the utmost clarity. Even a newcomer at the Talmud could come in and understand what the Rav was talking about. Rav Chaim had said that if you cannot explain your Sfarah to a child, it means you don't really understand what you're saying. Right? As an aside, this has nothing to do with Rav Soloveitchik. I once read an article about this kid telling that when he was like in elementary school, he was friendly with this old man in the park, back in the days when it was okay to be friendly with an old man in the park. And they would talk, and he'd say, what are you doing in school? He'd tell him what he's doing in his science class. And he said, you know, I know a little about the subject. If you want, I can come in. And he tells his teacher about this guy who knows something. And the teacher is blown away when his friend in the park is Albert Einstein, who comes into the elementary school class and explains the theory of relativity, and they all got it. Because if you really understand it, you can explain it to a child. Okay, close parentheses. Now, the Rav didn't just teach Brisker Torah. He was Mechadish. Now, Rav Chaim had two sons, Rav Moshe, who ended up in America, and Rav Velbel, who ended up in Israel. So once there was a student who studied by the Rav's cousins in Eretz Israel, and then came and learned by the Rav in America. And when someone asked him to compare the two, he said, in Eretz Israel, it's like a river. It keeps the Brisker Torah flowing. But here, Rav Soloveitchik, it's a Ma'ayana Mitgaber. It's a wellspring that keeps shooting out Chidushim. It's not just saying over Chidushim. It's shooting out new Chidushim all the time. He gave Shiurim in all Shisha Sidrei, you know, Gemaras from all over, Mishnah from all over. He made Gemara Brachos or Masechet Kalim as interesting as, you know, Bava Metzia or Kedushin. In the summers in Boston, he taught all sorts of things. One summer, Minchas Chinuch. Another summer, Avos Rebbe Nassim. One summer, he decided to teach Tanya. Now, Rabbi Menachem Gnack, head of the OU, tells a story that he was there one summer. It was the summer they started to teach Tanya. And he, some of the other students, they were disappointed. They came to Boston to learn with the Rav, Gemara. They don't want to learn Tanya. And the Rav saw it on the faces and told the following story. He said, Yud Lamed, Yitzchak Lev Peretz, wrote this book called Ben Shnei, told the story of Ben Shnei Harim. And in this story, the Rav's namesake, his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, had a student that became a Hasidish Rav, the Biala Rebbe. And in this story, the Biala Rebbe invites the Beis HaLevi, come join me in my Hasidim for a day. See what it's like. And he comes in to the Hasidish Beis Medrash. And here it is, they start to sing. And he describes how the day, all of a sudden, the cold winter day, the snow begins to melt. And the gray skies, all of a sudden, the sun starts to shine through. And the trees begin to blossom. And the birds are chirping. And then it's getting late in the day. And the Beis HaLevi goes, nu mincha, mincha. And at that moment, the sky got gray again, and the snow, and it was dark and cold and dreary. And the Rav pointed to Rabbi Gnack and said, that's you. Okay, he wanted to convey not just the logic, but the passion of Torah. This is what he wanted to try to show. At times, he would talk freely how the Shekhinah, he felt the Shekhinah looking over his shoulder, how he felt the Shekhinah saying, Nu, Yashaber, how are you going to answer this question on the Rambam? No, what's the teretz for the problem over here? And he said that it was only due to this closeness that he felt with the Kaddish Baruch Hu in his learning that he made it through his triple Avelis of 1967. In 1 year, his mother, then his brother, then his wife passed away. And he said if it wouldn't have been for his closest that he felt to a Kaddish Baruch Hu through the learning, he wouldn't have made it through. Just to get in that feeling of how close he was to Torah. Torah was the most important thing to him. I once got the opportunity to go and speak to Rav Soloveitchik. I've mentioned to you guys before, I was involved in these seminars for public school kids, and in this particular seminar, I was in charge of tefillah. And I had a whole bunch of questions I wanted to ask the Rav. I wanted to ask him about Kiddush Levana for women, saying stuff in English, you know, all sorts of different questions. And I asked him, I had a list, I asked all these questions. And he said to me when I was finished, he said, "Whose shir are you in?" I said, "We're Parnas." He says, "All right, you know, you should learn Torah too. Don't just daven all day." And I was like, "Okay, I'll keep that in mind." You know, but like, you know, I asked him these tefillah questions. They're all saying, you know, learn Torah. Okay, okay. Now, before 1967, the Rav was a tyrant in shir. Woe to the person who came to shir unprepared. I mean, the Rav would call upon you, and you're asked all the questions. I say, "Fleischner, all right, read the Gemara." I start reading. I goes, "All right, what's the problem in the Gemara?" What does the Baal HaMor say? You know, how did the Mechamah say Hashem? Well, you know, what's the Sfar? What do you think he said? You're asked all, you better, and if let's say, I didn't get this. What? You didn't see? How did you not see? You know, and you were ripped to smithereens. Okay? One guy tells a story how in the shirim that they had, you know, the architecture wasn't as good. There was like a pillar in the middle of the room because they couldn't keep the ceiling up at that time without a pillar in the room. He would every day run behind the pillar. So you should make eye contact with the Rav. You know, he's scared, right? So one day the Rav's looking around, who's going to read? He just looks on his sheet and he goes, "Yeah, Goldner, read the Gemara." Goldner's a guy sitting behind the pillar. And he goes, "Yeah, Goldner's not here today." Yeah. He goes, "All right, you read. All right, fine." So whatever. So it was scared out of their minds. Okay. Now, after the triple Avelis, the Rav changed. Instead of being this harsh father-like figure, I mean, the Rav ran his shir the way a commander runs an elite commander unit. There's no room for sissies here. Either you stay with the program or you get out, right? That's the way the Rav was. He was a harsh father. After the triple Avelis, he became this loving grandfather, right? You didn't know, you said something stupid. The Rav didn't make fun of you. It was just like, okay, no, it goes like this. So about 10 years ago, I was on this panel at a hotel, Pesach. The Rav passed away, Chalamay Pesach. So it was a panel of former students of Rav Soloveitchik. I'm talking about Rav Soloveitchik on the panel. So a friend of mine, Stewie Shapiro, lives in Ranana. He was on the panel with me. And he got up there and he spoke and he said, "Sometimes I meet students of the Rav from the 50s and 60s. And when I tell them I learned by the Rav in the 70s, they say to me, that wasn't really learning by the Rav. That wasn't the Rav." And he said, I still remember this as it was yesterday, he goes, "You don't think I know that? I would give my right arm to have been able to have been a student of the Rav in the 50s and the 60s. Right? There was a metamorphosis at this time. Now, the Rav taught his students by becoming one of them. He would ask questions and wait for answers. Sometimes he'd give his own answers. Then he'd become his own harshest critic and rip apart the stuff. No, that doesn't make any sense. Sometimes he would even fake. I don't really know. You know, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said about his father-in-law, the Rav, not only was Rav Soloveitchik the world's greatest mechanic, he was also the world's greatest actor. Like, you know, I don't really know. Someone help me here. I don't know what's going on here, right? This is what the Rav would do all the time. And as a master pedagogue, he would always sum up. All right, what do we see today? And he would organize everything they did so it should be clear to you before he finished. His brisker derech, chakiras, conceptualization, was taken everywhere. If the Vilna Gaon looked for sources from Minhagim, the Rav learned lumdus from Minhagim, especially Minhagim of Tefillah. He would tell you what the chakiras are and explaining the Minhagim. The first book that the Rav published, Halachic Man, in 1941. This was written to both glorify the life of halacha and also as a polemic against those who thought that you had to like chuck traditional Judaism if you wanted to be rational. The Rav felt any philosophy of Judaism has to be grounded in the conceptual world of halacha. If Heschel could talk about Shabbos being like a mishkan in time, very poetic, the Rav said, Shabbos is the lamatam halachas. That's how we deal with it. Another one of the Rav's articles that turned into a book, became a book, and widely read as Lonely Man of Faith. And in it, he compares the two, first Prakam of Bereshis, Perek Aleph, Perek Bet, the different depictions of the creation of Adam. And he says the Torah's teaching is two aspects of being a human being. And he referred to them as Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is majestic man. He has intelligence, creativity, dignity, the ability to control and dominate the environment. Adam, too, he called covenantal man. He looks at the mystery of the universe. He's redemptive man. He doesn't try to control the external world, but rather himself. Adam 1 might ask how things happen. Adam 2 would be talking about why and trying to figure that out. And he says these are both obligations on each and every one of us. And therefore, we have to deal with problems that confront society. Not because we're Jews, but because we're human beings. We have to deal with poverty and disease and all other social problems. This is our job as Mamleches Kohanim. This is Maleches HaKodesh. Torah commands us to be involved in medicine and technology, economy and politics, security and social sciences. The Rav isn't saying that every Jew has to become a doctor or a psychiatrist, an economist or a general, but he felt he most definitely should understand the role of those people in society. It's clear that the Rav also was opposed to putting yourself into a little ghetto. He didn't think that was the answer. And rather, he felt that we should be productive members of our society, and he felt academic education is therefore a necessity. And now, we can understand the uniqueness of Rav Soloveitchik, at least begin to understand the uniqueness of Rav Soloveitchik. He was, on the one hand, traditional Rosh Yeshiva, who had a doctorate from the University of Berlin. He was a brilliant Talmudic scholar who was fluent in all contemporary thought, equally adept in Rambam and in Kierkegaard. Another area where the Rav differed from most Gedolim in the United States of this time was his association with religious Zionism. After much soul-searching, Cheshbon and Nefesh, the Rav does an about-face in the 40s, in the late 40s, and he joins Mizrahi. He said, I feel that the Hashgachat Hashem is employing secular Jews, the Chilonim, as shlichim, to enact his plan in regard to the Holy Land. And he said the years of the Nazi Holocaust, the rise of the State of Israel, and the accomplishments of the Mizrahi movement in Eretz Israel have convinced me of the justice of the path of this movement. Now the Rav also said, we know that Chazal all the time say nothing is created without a purpose. We have all sorts of midrashim to discuss this. And if so, therefore he said, when on Hei Iyar 1948 God said, let there be a state of Israel, it was not in vain. The Rav felt that Hashem tells us through historical events who is right. And therefore he has this famous drasha called Yosef Ha'echad, where he says that the machlokas between Joseph and his brothers, the machlokas Hashem Shemaim, Yosef dreamt of stars and sheaves growing in the field, and he said this was Mizrahi, saying that we're coming to a new time period. We need to be involved in technology, we need to be involved in agriculture. And the brothers said, no, we continue living our lives the way we've been doing until now. And the way that the brothers didn't understand that Yosef was really there to save them, so too, Aguda didn't understand that Mizrahi was there to save them. And Mizrahi was right. And we're now moving into a new era. We're moving into Eretz Israel, where we need technology, we need the agro, we need to be involved in the land. The Rav being involved in religious Zionism fits in to his outlook on being partners with Hashem in creation. But his Zionism wasn't like Rav Kook. Rav Kook viewed this as, you know, atchalta de geula, messianic overtones. The Rav, it was based on the suffering of the Holocaust and on the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, but it wasn't eschatological for Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav being involved in religious Zionism fits in with his outlook on being partners with Hashem in creation. All right, like everything else, the Rav viewed his Zionism in halachic terms. He said, since anyone who's killed because he is Jewish dies al Kiddush Hashem, all soldiers that protect the welfare and security of the State of Israel and is killed is considered to have died al Kiddush Hashem. And there's this crazy story that Rav Schechter, I've heard him tell a few times, and every time he tells it, he cries. In the early years of the state, Aguda decided to have a convention in Eretz Israel. And some of the rabbis from New York felt uncomfortable. They went to this hotel, and there was an Israeli flag flying overhead. Pasnish, an Israeli flag, you know, we don't hold from the Medina. So what did they do? What was the idea? They said, all right, let's put up flags from all the countries where all the rabbis came from. And then there was an article in the newspaper where this reporter took them to task and said, let me get this straight. The British flag, the Union Jack, that patrolled the coast of Israel, that didn't allow Holocaust survivors into Eretz Israel, that sent them back to their death, that flag is kosher? But the Mugging David of Medina Israel, that's treif, right? When this article came out, someone went over to Soloveitchik and asked him, what does he think? Soloveitchik said, these rabbis, they don't get it. This is not a flag. It's not a flag like every country's got a flag. Some sports teams have flags. It's not a flag. There's a halacha of Big Day Harug, that if you are killed, you don't get buried in Tachrichim. You get buried in the clothes you were killed in, to be Ma'orer Rachamim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says you have soldiers that gave their lives to put a flag on a hilltop, on the top of a building, in the War of Independence, trying to say which part of Eretz Yisrael is going to be ours. The flag of Eretz Yisrael is Big Day Harug. This is the way Rav Soloveitchik viewed this. One of the most interesting aspects of the Rav is that his Talmidim are so varied. Many disagree with him on major issues, and this is by design. He never wanted to impose his particular attitude upon others and never wanted to give his opinion as Das Torah. This is the way to view it. He often said that he aspires to have Talmidim and not Hasidim. He wanted people to challenge him, to question him, not just to accept every single thing that he said. He said that when the Mishnah, Perkei Avot, says, Yamidu Talmidim Harbe, it doesn't mean to have a lot of students. It means to set up your students so they can stand on their own 2 feet. The Rav became the unofficial postek for modern Orthodoxy. And his sheer presence, in many ways, was threatening to the Haredim. Rav Shach wouldn't let his students look at the Rav's Chidushei Torah, because if they saw how amazing his Chidushei Torah, Baba Kama, they might pick up his Hashkafas for him. So, stay away from it. So there's a guy, Zev Aleph. He was a student of ours here in the yeshiva. He was Rav Korn's Talmud. And he put out, when he went to YU, this book, I think it was called Memories of a Giant, and he interviewed students from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, telling stories about Rav Soloveitchik. And since he was a student here in the yeshiva, he decided one of the people would be Rav Bina, which is sort of funny because Rav Bina was learned by the Rav for 1 year. But whatever, Rav Bina's got an article in the book. And of course, Zev Aleph touched up the English before he put it to print. But he could tell also that he touched up some of the things. You could see exactly what Rabina really meant and what Zev Aleph wrote very politically correct. But the story that Rabina tells is when he comes to America, so his Haredi brothers-in-law started saying to him, you can't go to YU, right? I'm going to learn at YU, but learn of Soloveitchik, no way, it's terrible. So in the end, as we know, Rabina went and he learned at YU. And then, some months later, those same Haredi brothers-in-law said to him, he goes, do you have any notes from the Rav Shir? To which I know, you know, in the thing, it's politely, he said, politely he refused. For sure, Bina said, go to hell. Right? We know that, right? We know that he said that. But anyway, in Zev Aleph's book, and then Rabina politely refused, whatever it was. The Seder. The Rav allowed interfaith dialogue, but only on moral issues, not dogma. He broke from right-wing world because he refused to leave the synagogue council, because that would cause divisiveness in the Jews and in the community affairs. He felt there should be cooperation. Religious Jews and non-religious Jews, when it comes to welfare of Jews, state of Israel, we can work together. And in this, he's influenced by his great-great-grandfather, Netziv, who felt the same way. We spoke about that a few weeks ago. He often would tell the story about his grandfather, Reb Chaim, went around on Yom Kippur raising money to save a Jew who was about to be executed, and the Jew himself was an atheist. There's a concern for all of Klal Yisrael. And yet, the Rav felt Reform and Conservative Judaism was absolutely treif, and it's better not to hear Tkiyat Shofar on Rosh Hashanah than to daven in a shul without a mechitza. So, as a person, the Rav said, we can work together. As a, you know, an ideology, obviously it's treif. He broke from Haredim with his secular wisdom, as we say in Gemara Megillah, Yesh Chacham Bagayim, and the Rav said, it's an open Gemara. He joined the ranks of Gedolim throughout the centuries who possessed great secular wisdom. Shtadigo and the Rambam, Rabbeinu Bachai, the Ramah, the Malbim, the Gra. But the truth is, in the 20th century, not that many Gedolim were also holding in secular wisdom. He stressed that scientific and technological creativity also constitutes an intrinsic valuable mode of imitating God. As we said before, Adam won. And the Rav encouraged many students to pursue graduate degrees. The Rav's endorsement of secular Zionism is related to his belief that taking the initiative is religiously mandated to be partners with God in creation, diametrically opposed to the Haredi view, like wait till God brings us. So I said before, and this is, I'll end with this, I saw this in an article, that the Rav had this article, and he said that Yosef was there to save the brothers, the way Mizrahi was there to save Klal Yisrael at this important time period. And if so, maybe we'll say the same thing about this Yosef. With his secular wisdom and his great Torah knowledge, maybe he was there, he had the ability to relate to contemporary culture, and he was there to save American Jewry at this critical juncture. Okay, we'll stop here. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week we will...